This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative, a new initiative aimed at providing different groups across Indianapolis the opportunity to receive funding to help them continue their work addressing issues that impact the African American community in Indianapolis. With us now are Tony Mason, President and CEO of the Indianapolis Urban League, and Willis Bright, the Chair of the African American Coalition of Indianapolis and the Co-Director of the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tony, I'll start with you. Can you talk about how the National Urban League received the $100 million grant from the Lilly Endowment?
Sure. Last June, I was initially contacted by the Lilly Endowment to discuss an intentional effort that they wanted us to embark on, an effort that would be transformational for the city of Indianapolis's African-American residents. And so I was asked to brainstorm some thoughts and ideas on what we could do that could work. And ultimately, I made the recommendation that since the grant amount, the $100 million grant amount, was so substantial that we could not receive it directly, that the Indianapolis Urban League would partner with the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis, but that the funding itself would be received by the National Urban League. That being that the $100 million grant amount would have ultimately changed our categorization or tax status. It would have converted us into a small community foundation, whereas that amount would not have had the same impact on the National Urban League. I also felt like it would be great for the National Urban League from a standpoint of the Urban League starting to look at and to take steps to look at how funding could be more substantial during such a struggling period of time for people all across the country, especially African-Americans in cities, urban centers and locations all over America. And so they were excited to receive the grant and are excited to be a part of this initiative.
And what role does the Indianapolis Urban League play when it comes to the grant? I know you mentioned that it's kind of been given to the National Urban League to disperse it. But what role specifically are you playing?
So the role that I am specifically playing in the Indianapolis Urban League, first and foremost, is we're partnering with the Indianapolis African-American Coalition. But we're also co-administering and co-leading the effort in partnership with the National Urban League, as well as with Mr. Bright and the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis. So we play a major role in the local administration of the grant, the related efforts for the initiative.
Willis, what does the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative aim to do?
What we aim to do is to make strategic investments in five areas. The issue areas that we plan to make strategic investments in are education, employment, health, housing, and business development, African-American business development. In addition, because we also are interested in building the capacity of organizations that are Black-led, we will be doing things to both develop further leadership of all ages, and also building the capacity of organizations. We hope that the opportunity to work in the issue areas will provide an opportunity for multiple organizations within the community, both those within the African-American community, but also in the broader community, to try some new ways of addressing deep concerns and issues in the areas that I spoke to.
And this might sound like a very obvious answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why was there a need for this initiative specifically in Indianapolis?
Well, specifically in Indianapolis, and like you said, it's obvious on one hand. The reality of it is in Indianapolis and Marion County, we have nearly 250,000 African-Americans. And 30% of them are poor. We know that 70% of our African-American students, our young people, fail to pass standardized exams We have to look no further back than the recent test scores on the I-STEP I-Learn test for third through eighth grade in our community and in our state, where we know that less than 10% of African-American students pass those tests. We know that we have 82,000 African-Americans in Indianapolis who live in food deserts. We also know that the health disparities are staggering and have been further exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I could tell you that the list goes on. And so the intentionality around this grant provided by Lilly Endowment and the engagement of the Indianapolis Urban League, the African American Coalition, and our desire to engage the community to get, you know, their thoughts, feelings, and opinions about their quality of living and what the priorities should be is important, as well as the engagement of our thought leaders and experts sitting at the table and working with other community organizations on what the priorities should be in the areas that Willis mentioned was so important, because the challenges and the needs, the barriers and obstacles are so large and so substantial that it's going to take all of us in order to find solutions to address the challenges facing African Americans and to therefore improve the quality of living of African Americans in our city.
Willis, when it comes to the five areas that you mentioned, how was that determined that that's what you wanted to focus on?
The African American Coalition had some years ago begun to have conversations with African American residents to identify what they saw as key issues impacting the community, as well as looking at the research that's been done on social issues that has been done by multiple research and social entities in the community. And out of those conversations, out of that data analysis, we then identified those particular areas. It doesn't take an awful lot to look at the kinds of trends related to education, look at the condition of housing, to look at what has happened, especially during COVID, as it relates to the African-American community, to see not only the disparities that exist, but the lack of resources that have been dedicated to eradicating those issues. And while we believe that the dollars we bring will help improve quality of life over time, we also are not naive enough to think that $100 million, even well used and well leveraged, will in and of itself eradicate issues that have been persistent for years. But by being strategic and partnering with other entities, foundations, corporate and individuals, we hope to be directing resources in ways that can make a measurable difference.
It's funny because I was actually going to ask that question of, is $100, $100 million enough to invest into the community in Indianapolis? And my thought would be, not just money is necessary, but changing the system overall. So, Tony, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, we know that we have to address systemic racism, institutional racism, and all of the barriers that exist that, frankly, African-Americans do not control. We view this grant as seed money, if you will, and that there is a substantial opportunity for it to be leveraged into additional dollars that could be invested in the initiative, either directly or indirectly, through other major efforts, racial equity efforts that are underway in our city. And so we know that there are synergies and alignment between what we are attempting to do through this effort and what is being planned and is underway through the Business Equity for India initiative. And that being, we know that there will be job opportunities and career paths that will open up for African Americans through that initiative. We know that there will be efforts in the area of procurement. And what will that mean for Black businesses and entrepreneurs? We also know that there will be a concerted focus on education and addressing the achievement gap, as well as looking at health disparities. We also know that there is an alignment and synergy between what we're doing as a part of this work and as it relates to the Corporate and Community Partners for Racial Equity Initiative, where we are working closely with corporations such as Lilly, Cummins, Salesforce, AT&T, and others to look at policy issues that need to be addressed, not only at the state legislature, but local government as well. Because we know that there are many instances where there's policy that is impacting the quality of living and the access to opportunities for people in our city. We know that through partnerships, there's potential for this $100 million grant to hopefully be leveraged into $200 million or $300 million worth of investment. We know that we cannot do this work alone. And so I know myself, Willis Bright, and all of the individuals that you're speaking with today as a part of this interview are playing a major role in spreading the word and engaging potential partners and supporters for this effort.
Well, we have a minute before we go to break. Willis, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that Tony has spoken well to what it will require for there to be change. And we're also aware, too, that it will require great coordination and cooperation between organizations within the African American community as well as individuals. One of the things that the African American Coalition has tried to do over the last 20 years is to bring organizations together to both learn together about concerns in the community as well as to exercise using his collective voice to comment on all kinds of issues or to negotiate, whether it's with IMPD or with the mayor's office or with others, to address concerns. So one of the essential elements will be not only the dollar resources and mobilizing human resources, but also coordinating and invigorating the cooperative exchange that has occurred historically between Black organizations and making sure that we are working together to be able to help affect some changes.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the needs and priorities of the African-American community in Indianapolis with leaders of a new initiative called the Indianapolis African-American Quality of Life Initiative. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. With us again are Tony Mason, President and CEO of the Indianapolis Urban League, and Willis Bright, the Chair of the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis and the co-director of the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative. Willis, before the break, you mentioned that the African American Coalition had been doing this for the last 20 years or so, looking into quality of life type topics. Is this just now getting more attention because of this grant? It sounds like this has been going on for a long time.
The activities that the coalition has been involved in is to really try to get the African American community in a coordinated way more engaged in the political process. That has included having candidate forums. It's included putting statements together about issues, whether it be police action shootings or school board decisions to have a referendum or other things that we think would impact the quality of life of African Americans. So we have been doing that for a while, and we now, and as a part of this initiative, have been a source of trying to get African American input into not only our own strategies and what it is we propose to do, but also to raise that voice around what are the things that we should have as concerns and that could be corrective measures to improve quality of life. So it's all come together in a way, and that makes very good sense to us.
Now, Tony, has there ever been a grant like this for Indianapolis before?
Not to my knowledge, for an undertaking focused specifically on African Americans. What I will say is that organizations like the Indianapolis Urban League, Indiana Black Expo, the NAACP, the 100 Black Men, I can think of numerous organizations whose mission and work over decades have primarily focused on these issues. But the challenge has always been, in many instances, that nonprofits rarely have the investment and the dollars and the resources to try to make substantial transformative change. And so this grant allows the opportunity for us to all collectively to work together to attempt to address these issues. And that's why it's so important, it being a place-based making grant. We recognize that in a perfect world, from a national standpoint, our hope is that this will become a funding model in cities across the country. You know, there are 90 Urban League affiliates across America. And so just imagine if other foundations and endowments duplicated this sort of effort, what it could mean for improving the quality of living for African Americans, opening the doors for greater opportunities for our students, for workers, for businesses, getting at and addressing disparities that we face on all levels. You know, when we look at issues such as housing, and we think about the eviction crisis that we're experiencing right now, we have the challenge of people being evicted, or if they achieve what is called a soft landing, meaning they leave the property but without an eviction on their record, well, where do people go? Where do they move to? That's a challenge here in our community when we know that there are less than 500 quality, affordable workforce housing units in this community. That's a real challenge that has to be addressed, particularly in African American neighborhoods that are gentrifying daily. And so that's just an example of a challenge. We know that African-American employees and workers in many instances are challenged with not receiving livable wages. You know, in our community, we're still dealing with $7.25 per hour as minimum wage. You can't live off of that, you know, based on the economy. And when we talk about housing and affordable housing, before the pandemic, I do believe we had over 50,000 people in our state and a lot of people in this city that were housing cost burden, meaning over a third of their wages were going towards housing, which only set those families up for failure, for eviction, for struggles when the pandemic hit. And so this grant gives us the opportunity to build upon the work that all of our existing organizations have been doing, but now to look at it through a transformational lens, which is important in this moment.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us, and I appreciate everything that you shared with us. Willis, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly add that there might be some that would say, why a dedicated focus on the African-American community? And I would simply say, all one has to do is look at the indices of health, of wealth, of prosperity in every area, and you will find that African Americans are at or near the bottom of those criteria and evaluators. So it is not simply that there should be favoritism per se, but if we're going to move the community as a whole, one has to invest in groups that are not achieving to the same level as other citizens.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Tony Mason is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Urban League, and Willis Bright is the chair of the African American Coalition of Indianapolis and a co-director of the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative. We're continuing our conversation about a new initiative aimed to provide funding to groups addressing challenges facing the African American community in Indianapolis. To learn more about the process of figuring out what those challenges are, we're joined by Debbie Evans, former managing principal of Engaging Solutions, and Marshawn Wally, consultant for IAAQLI and president and CEO of Black Onyx Management. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Debbie, what work have you been doing for the initiative?
Well, our firm, Engaging Solutions, was responsible for handling all of the community engagement at the grassroots, as well as some community leader level activities. We refer to that part of the project as the community opportunities assessment. So that's what we have been leading and being actively engaged in.
Marshawn, what about your role?
So I was privileged to partner with Engaging Solutions in implementing the community-wide survey. We did youth focus groups and then supporting the public leader meetings and community leadership meetings. We also did one-on-one interviews with leaders in the community.
Debbie, what did you hear back and from the feedback that you got and the different folks that you spoke with?
Well, let me share that Marshawn mentioned some of the work that he did. So let me back up a sec, if that's okay.
So
our overall process included, as Marshawn mentioned, interviewing some community leaders and key stakeholders in the Indianapolis Marion County area. We also held several public meetings as well as community leader meetings. And then we had a team of community grassroots organizers who literally knocked on doors and opened up their contact list to reach out to people to ask them what their thoughts were about the issues, challenges, and opportunities that African Americans are facing in Indianapolis and Marion County. And what we heard was no one cares about us. That's one of the primary points that was raised. We also heard that Black people in Indianapolis and Marion County are continuing to struggle. Tony mentioned 30% of the population are poor. And so what we heard was, what happens to people in Indianapolis and Marion County, Black people in Indianapolis and Marion County, who are poor? They struggle with quality access to quality education. They struggle with access to jobs that will allow them to make more, to make a living wage. They struggle living in blighted communities in Indianapolis and Marion County. They struggle with access to business entrepreneurship opportunities. They struggle with mental health and other physical and overall general health conditions. And so those are some of the things that that we heard. The barriers are real. The institutional racism is real. And the challenges that we heard about are challenges that have been happening for generations to Black people in Indianapolis and Marion County.
With that being said, you know, I wonder, how does this grant that just came out change all of the stuff that's been known for so many generations to be happening in Indianapolis?
Well, it is our hope through the process that we have implemented for this initiative that we heard from people at the grassroots level. We heard from community and civic leaders. We prioritized what we heard. That information, that data will help to inform what the priorities are that the funding from the Lilly grant will address. And ultimately, the dollars, as Willis and Tony have already mentioned, will go to starting to address some of those challenges that have been raised. $100 million, we know, may not be enough. And so it's a way of getting started by addressing some of the significant issues that have been prioritized from what we heard from the community.
Marshawn, what are your thoughts on the feedback that you heard?
I think it was very important for us to be able to have the opportunity to capture what was really a community conversation on both the challenges and the opportunities. I really appreciated the times that we got a chance to talk to young people specifically. We did focus groups, and then we also did a town hall. And one key finding that really stood out to me was how we can think about sustainability. And sustainability was presented in two ways. First, in our community meetings, the thought was to get our young people exposed to excellence from around the country and then to have them come back. And then from the young people themselves, they really bought into the process and they viewed themselves as part of the sustainability strategy for anything that we might do. And so that was very both inspiring to see that, but and also just very informative in the way that our young people have really kind of looked at this process and said, you know, that they can be a part of it too.
Marshawn, earlier, I think one of our guests, maybe Tony or Willis, mentioned that this can become an example for other cities across the country. Do you think this will become an example, or have you looked to any other cities as an example for how to create change in Indianapolis?
Certainly. One of the first things that we did was a scan of just opportunities from around the country, looking at various kind of leadership groups, looking at various centers for public policy, for business development, and things of that nature. One of the things we discovered was this particular opportunity is unique in the sense that you have a sizable amount of dollars focused on placemaking. But throughout the, particularly the Midwest region, you do have Black leaders coming together to try to do various things. Again, our situation is different in the sense that we've had Black leaders working together, African-American Coalition being one of them, where we're working on different public policy issues and things of that nature, but we've not had the resources, particularly the resources at this level, to do placemaking. And so I do think that it is potentially a model for community intervention moving forward.
And Debbie, what are your thoughts?
Certainly agree that that we know there have been a variety of ways in which communities have dug deep to find out what the issues and challenges are and come up with solutions. It is our hope that this Indianapolis model will become a national model that other communities will want to replicate, and we'll be able to share our best practices from what we learned here in Indianapolis as a part of this quality of life initiative. It is also our hope that other corporations in Indianapolis will want to jump on board and actually help to leverage the dollars from Lilly to address these huge issues in the Black community in Indianapolis and Marion County.
Well, what's next for this initiative? What are the next steps now after you've collected the data and I guess networking with other leaders and organizations?
Great question. So I mentioned that this initiative has several layers to it. The first layer was for us to talk to the community, talk to African-American, the Black population across Indianapolis and Marion County, gather that information, analyze it, and present it to the next phase. The next phase, phase two, was for us to take all of those challenges, that issues and recommendations even that we heard in phase one, and share that information with our colleague who led the issues prioritization process, of which we had a variety of community leaders, thought leaders, who led conversations with other community thought leaders in Indianapolis to prioritize the issues, opportunities, and recommendations that we heard. That was part two. Part three, and probably the final part for from an organizational standpoint, is that we will take those issues that were prioritized. We will go through a grant-making process that will be fairly extensive and have a foundation of experienced grant writers coming up with selection criteria to make decisions ultimately on where the dollars will be allocated to address the prioritized issues. And then beyond that, I believe there's opportunity for us to continue to flush out what phase four and beyond will be.
Well, we have about a minute left. Marshawn, what are your hopes for the next steps of this initiative?
My hope is that as we get through the process of the RFP process, that we have organizations that step forward, that come up with innovative practices that address the key priorities that have been identified by the community, and that we really start to do the hard work of intervening and moving our community forward. I think it's remarkable that at this time of crisis where we've experienced both a pandemic, an economic downturn, and then a racial reckoning, that Indianapolis has this unique position to really intervene and define the trajectory of where we want to go in the future. And so I'm just excited as a young professional to be here and really looking forward to what comes out of this. There's a lot of energy in our community, particularly the young professionals, and they're really, really excited to be here and are hopeful and optimistic about what may come.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We've been talking about the African American Quality of Life Initiative, and with us now is another leader of the Indianapolis Project, Carlin Tishner, the Director of Operations for IAAQLI. Welcome to the program, Carlin.
I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
So how did you get involved in this initiative?
Well, the interesting story is I was transplanted back from Indianapolis. I grew up in Indianapolis and since went to college and was away for about 14 years. Came back and was able to connect to Willis Bright. And through some project work that he and I were doing together, we started to develop a relationship, and he was able to see some skills of mine that were transferable. Ultimately, I was a part of the initial conversation with he and Tony Mason about this announcement. And from there, we began to develop an opportunity for me to participate in creating the issues prioritization process.
And that was a huge announcement, which we'll probably touch up on in a minute. But what is your role as the Director of Operations for the initiative entail?
Yeah, it's still evolving, being that we are in the first year. But as I mentioned, my initial role was to design the expert review process. Ultimately, we were seeking experts across the city of Indianapolis, Marion County, to help us develop and identify what priorities need to be funded across the five pillars: education, business, entrepreneurship, housing and home ownership, health and wellness, and employment. And from there, now my role is to essentially move us from idea to grant initiation. And so I'll be responsible for helping to design the RFP process, response for proposals, helping to design the evaluation process, the review of the applications for the grants, and then ultimately helping the community to understand how to apply for the grants through technical assistance and supporting the efforts of the community to implement their grants with fidelity toward the end of the grant cycle, which is a five-year process.
And for our listeners who are tuning in, the announcement was this $100 million. And can you explain to us how it's going to be used?
Absolutely. And so we really are designing a grant fund. The initiative is really designed around creating dollars and creating an opportunity for organizations to invest in this fund that would ultimately create space for organizations who are investing in those five pillars that I mentioned before. And so we are a grant fund initially, and we're also interested in leveraging our funds to create space for other organizations who are like-minded, who have interest in equity and serving the African-American community with funding to create an opportunity for us to leverage and align what we are accomplishing and working toward to organizations and their interest in doing so similarly.
You mentioned getting expert voices into the mix. Why is it important to get their voices as well as that of the community?
So any place-based initiative, evidence suggests that the voice of the community impacted by such an initiative is essential. And so we design not only the expert opportunity, but also the community voice opportunity through the community opportunities assessment, which you guys will talk about in a little bit. But the expert role was really a vital key aspect of us being able to identify what those priorities would be. Experts are doing the work every day. They're either researching the issues or they're actually investing their time, talents, and energy into resolving those gaps. And so we certainly believe that engaging the experts would help us identify those priorities that would be evidence-based, that would be sustainable, and ultimately that would have immediate impact on the community for years to come.
And there were five areas that were focused on when you were speaking with folks and interviewing them about their concerns. I believe it's education, housing, employment, business, and mental health. What made it get to that sort of focus of those five areas?
Yeah, so years ago, in 2019, I believe, the Black Agenda was created, which was designed around the idea that there are issues in the Black community, and the individuals that had the power, the politicians, the mayoral candidates, and others needed to understand the conditions within the Black community such that they could identify strategy. And in that process, these categories emerged, and they've been refined ever since. But we also know that when we think about wealth gaps and equity gaps and opportunities for long-term quality of life, that these five categories are very important in creating positive quality of life for individuals, but especially individuals who are minoritized in our context, African Americans. So education, home ownership, and housing, those are wealth builders. Also employment, obviously, if you don't have access to employment, your quality of life is significantly diminished. And then your health and wellness, the quality of your life is affected by health and wellness, but not limited to that. The reality that we need large and small businesses and growing aspects of African Americans who are leading these agencies and organizations is vital to the overall economic growth of our community. So that's part of the reasons why these five were identified.
Was it challenging to collect any of the data?
Well, I think anytime you are collecting data and bringing together several people for one purpose is to understand what some priorities need to be. It is challenging, but I would say that the biggest challenge was the design of the process. The most exciting reality that we learned is that people are invested, interested, and wanting to give voice to this project. And so as a result, I think that though we designed a process that was difficult to design initially, the folks who engaged, the volunteers, the facilitators, made it easy for us to collect the data.
With respect to COVID kind of coming to the mix for a lot of people this past year and a half, did that have any impact on collecting sort of the feedback from these experts? Did it make it more difficult, or was it easier doing Zoom calls?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what we learned through this process is that a hybrid model to collect data is probably more efficient. Now, what we lost in translation in the Zoom calls was the ability to record every aspect of every conversation and the nuances within that. We also lost the ability to create collaborative opportunities at the level that we could have through the process, because folks in many cases did not know each other, and through Zoom were able to at least learn something, but maybe not as much as they would have about one another and the organizations and the work that they're doing. But beside that, what we were able to do was create an efficient process that allowed folks to be present and engaged wherever they were, and to do so in a way that was meaningful. And so I think COVID helped us be efficient. What it hurt was our ability to ensure that folks developed relationships that would live beyond this experience. But what we know is that despite that, folks were still able to leverage new relationships, maintain existing relationships, and that there's energy that's coming from this process.
When you talk about the experts that you were speaking with, can you give us an idea of like the backgrounds? Are they involved in different organizations or corporate fields?
Yeah, so I'll use education as an example. So just imagine that we wanted to ensure the voice of experts across the lifespan of the field of education, from individual educators, from leaders in the education space, superintendents, principals, to organizations that support the educational space, higher education institutions, as well as technical assistance providers, consultants, that are investing in educational institutions. That's an example of the types of experts that we included. Translate that to the business and entrepreneurship space. You have business owners, you have folks that are providing technical assistance to businesses, you have major corporation representatives, you have folks that have been in the field for significant periods of time and have translated from leadership roles in corporations to now maybe independent practice, owning their own companies. It really crossed the gamut. These relationships were built through Willis Toney and the African American Coalition of Indianapolis and other community stakeholders, helping us identify these individuals that would help us be intentional about the types of priorities we created. So we leveraged relationships to identify these experts.
Was it easy to have open conversations with these experts about quality of life for the African-American community in Indianapolis?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, as I said earlier, these experts are already doing the work, have been doing the work and invested. What was most easy was to create the space for folks to be able to share their ideas, thoughts. The hardest part was really coming to consensus on what the immediate priorities are. Everyone knows the areas of growth, the opportunities, the gaps, and the equity issues. What we are struggling with and what we had to come to bear with is our ability to identify what needs to happen now. And that was the hardest part, but I would say it was still relatively seamless.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you have a lot of experts and folks and everybody has great ideas, it's hard to figure out which one to do first. Were you able to at least come up with one or two things that you'll, I guess, start immediately?
Yeah, we were. We were able to come up with a set of priorities across the pillars. We had five in each of the pillars at least, so a minimum of 30 priorities for the initiative. And what we did, what we're working on is specifically identifying which of these priorities across each pillars are advantageous today. And so we are closer to that. By next week, we will certainly have a list of really clear priorities that we will invest in the next few months.
Can you give us an example of what would be a priority? Just again, for folks who are listening that may not be really up to speed with what's going on.
Yeah. So I'll give an example in business and then one in education. So business, business and entrepreneurship, one of the key data points is that it takes an average of $17,000 for a would-be entrepreneur to invest in their own company. The truth is that the average American and the average Black American in Indianapolis and Marion County does not have that type of capital in their bank account. And so what priority that emerged in our process is the need to provide initial investments for African Americans who are interested in becoming entrepreneurs. And in that, it might create a community development fund that would invest in idea development and capacity building for an entrepreneur to be able to invest in a company and to do so without going into debt, recognizing that there are limitations with receiving loans from banks for Black Americans in general. Also true in Indianapolis, this fund would shore up the gap and create the opportunity for such growth and expansion for an entrepreneur. In education, we talked a lot about the need to grow professional development for educators and for leaders. When you think about the field of education, there's a reality that there's a lack of cultural responsiveness and training to that effect in higher education and in K-12 institutions. So the need to invest in professional development in those categories is important. And this fund would invest in programs, initiatives, and efforts that are intentionally focused on culturally responsive education and pedagogy development in educators and leaders. But also thinking about investing in the presence of Black educators, especially males, in the field of education, recruitment and retaining of these individuals. And so that's one of the priorities that came out. How can we invest in programs that are helping to grow representation in K-12 institutions for Black and brown kids as represented by the educator in front of them? We know data says that 2% of the field of education is Black and male. And so we certainly want to impact that data point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important for kids to be able to see themselves reflected in their mentors and teachers. And do you think this is part of that step forward?
Absolutely. And again, I use the word leverage a couple of times throughout this conversation because it is a step. It's an initial step. $100 million is a lot of money. $100 million is not a lot of money at the same time. And so we are making strides and steps, but we need engagement, we need collaboration, and we need additional investment in this step so that this step forward can become a long-term sustainable investment in making steps to resolve the quality of life for African Americans in this community.
And for people who are just tuning in, we're talking about the African-American quality of life in Indianapolis and the initiatives that are being put forward through a Lilly Endowment Fund. Can you tell us, Carlin, what has this shown so far about the quality of life for African-Americans in Indianapolis?
That we have work to do. We have learned from the community that their indication of not feeling like they're cared about, that there is no significant investment in their needs, that the basic needs are not being addressed, and that access to wealth and quality education and general opportunities for upward mobility is limited in our community. And so what we know and what we've known is that that is true. What we have an opportunity now to do, and many organizations have invested in this over decades, is to be intentional about how we fund programs and initiatives that can respond to what we know and to do so in a way that creates positive change. But we can't do it alone. We need community investment to help us continue to do that.
And when you say you need community investment, are you looking for folks outside of the organizations you're working with now to jump on board? How does that look?
Yeah, it's really like we would love for dollar investment. We would love for corporations to get behind these priorities and make a commitment financially to the effort. But in addition to the dollars, we certainly want organizations who are able to respond to the priorities that have emerged through this process to do so in a way that responds to our RFPs and to be intentional about how they develop programs and initiatives that are scalable, sustainable, and most importantly, impactful. And so, as well as the fact that we want corporations who are designing their own equity plans to think about what we've learned and what we've prioritized and consider how they might align their priorities to our priorities because our community has spoken to our priorities specifically.
So would it be fair to say if an organization is looking into equity and creating opportunities, they should align with your organization, talk to you, learn about the data and the research that you've done instead of trying to branch out on their own?
I think it would be helpful to learn about what data is out there first. We are certainly one part of that. There are other initiatives that have done some legwork to learn about what needs to happen. And so I would say not solely us, but us in addition to other work that's already been done to identify what are the opportunities to align to create intentional change. I would also say that the idea of reinventing a set of priorities without learning about what's already been prioritized by large-scale data sets or research initiatives, I think is important to consider. And what I would say is that if we can all align ourselves to a couple of priorities, 30 in our case, we would see more substantive change over time because we're all focused on very, very clear priorities at the same time.
Absolutely. And what do you personally hope to see come out of all of this? We have about a minute left.
Yeah. So personally, I certainly want to hear people say, African-Americans in Marion County, Indianapolis, I want to hear them say that their quality of life was significantly changed by this investment from the Lilly Endowment, by the commitment from the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis, the National Urban League, and the Indianapolis Urban League, and by the engagement of the community represented by corporations, collaborative organizations, and the applicants to the RFPs and the dollars that are made available. But more importantly, I also want them to be able to point to this time in history where an investment was translated to an impact that can be replicated here in Indianapolis, here in Marion County, but also nationally for populations that have historically been marginalized.
Thank you so much. Carlin Tishner is the Director of Operations for the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.